Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to Red Flags, a post-true crime boom true crime podcast from Investigation Discovery, where we talk about the warning signs, big and small.
We're your one-stop shop for all things true crime. The latest cases in the news and the shows and podcasts and books about them.
I'm Tori Telfer. I'm a true crime writer and podcaster who likes to focus on female criminals.
And I'm Karina Michelle, an armchair detective, but I also have a sociology degree to back it up. And I started talking about true crime on TikTok at Daily True Crime Minisodes.
And now she has over 200,000 followers.
Stop.
So, okay, Karina and I want to start by talking about some things we've been interested in consuming lately before we get into today's deep dive. Karina, I've been dying to tell you about this podcast I'm listening to because I don't think you've listened to it. And I have a lot of feelings about it. It's very niche.
Okay.
So the podcast is called For the Defense, and the host is named David Oscar Marcus. He's a Miami trial attorney, and it's basically a podcast where he interviews big deal criminal defense lawyers. So I'm into it because I've always sort of been into law. Like, I used to want to be a lawyer, and it's currently my backup. Like, when I'm 70, I think I'm going to go to law school and become a really cool badass old lady lawyer. You heard it here first. So I like it because it's very behind the scenes law, but it's also very controversial. Like, these lawyers say a lot of things that I don't agree with, and you probably wouldn't either from just like a moral level, but
yeah,
it illuminates how the courtroom is such a theater.
Yeah.
I was kind of thinking about it in terms of fake news. You know, we're all kind of like, there is such a thing as objective truth. And I kind of wonder if in the courtroom there isn't such a thing as objective truth. Because
everyone's really interesting.
Everyone's just spinning it. The defense is spinning it their way and the prosecution is spinning it their way. And that's what they're supposed to do. The first episode is with Harvey Weinstein's defense lawyer. It's a hard listen because, you know, she doesn't think he did anything wrong. And I mean, she says a lot of stuff that you and I would not agree with. But I do think as true crime consumers, it's actually very important for us to see this side of the criminal justice process, whether or not we agree with what the person is saying.
Yeah.
And then I also listened to an episode with Michael Jackson's lawyer, and it's full of these fascinating details, like why there were no black people on Michael Jackson's jury And it has to do with this whole mind game that he was playing with the prosecution. Like, it has nothing to do with the morals of our everyday lives as citizens. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It actually sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
I feel myself ready to binge listen
yes.
to it.
Yes. I think you'll like it. And I'm not endorsing what these lawyers yeah. say or do, but if you like true crime and you are interested in the courtroom, I think you'll find it pretty fascinating.
So speaking of binge listening, mm-hmm. it's become my favorite pastime in 2020. Mm-hmm. And Spotify just released their wrap up of everything that you were listening to this year. And it really called me out on my listening habits
oh, no.
when it comes to true crime podcast. Apparently, there's this podcast that I really loved called Crime Salad. And I listened to 12 of their episodes in one day. So that's like 12 hours of me.
How did you do it?
So my strategy is I clean my entire apartment.
Oh, yes.
And then whenever I feel like I'm done, I just make an excuse to clean something so that I can keep listening. So it's like, oh, the stove that I never use,
yes.
I'm going to clean this.
Cleaning while listening to a true crime podcast is like my truest pleasure.
Me too. That's my favorite thing.
Yes. So Crime Salad is about vegetarian crimes.
Yes. How did you know?
Intuition.
So no, every week they just post a different case. They don't really have anything niche about them. Mm-hmm. It's actually just general cases. Mm-hmm. But I like the way that they talk about them and they make it very digestible. Ha ha ha. And very easy to listen to, which is how
Clearly.
I ended up listening to 12 in one day.
I'm really sorry that Spotify exposed your deep, dark secret like that, though.
Yeah.
That wasn't fair.
It's okay. Yeah, maybe it was an intervention, but
yeah, I think
it's okay.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Speaking of binge listening, we're going to talk today about binge watching. So, you know, in this show, we're trying to take a look at the true crime landscape. So today we wanted to talk about serial killer movies and documentaries, which are obviously a huge chunk of this genre. There's a really weird relationship going on between serial killers and Hollywood, and we're going to get into it. We're also bringing on two guests to help us with this, Professor David Schmid, who studies a lot about serial killers and pop culture, and Kathy Kleiner, who is a survivor of Ted Bundy's 1978 Chi Omega attack. So I come to this subject from many, many years ago in 2018, when I thought I was really identifying a trend. There was a bunch of media about Ted Bundy coming out. The Zac Efron movie was yet to be released. Oxygen had just done a bunch of stuff on Ted Bundy. ID did a documentary called Ted Bundy, Mind of a Monster. And there was this indie short film called Friday, which is actually very amazing, making the rounds. And so I was like, we're in a Ted Bundy boom. I'm going to write about it. And so I pitched a piece to Vulture and wrote about it. And I really thought that I was seeing the top of the wave then. You know, after that, like, three movies about Manson came out with the 50th anniversary of those crimes. And
yeah,
now Netflix is putting out yet another Dahmer movie that's going to start filming roughly in January. So it's like these movies aren't going anywhere, especially movies about famous serial killers that have already had a bunch of movies made out of them. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wanted to talk about it, because it's so, I don't want to sound too judgmental because I watch these movies, but it seems a little unnecessary to me. Like, why do we need so many movies about Bundy and Manson and Dahmer? Sidebar. After my piece came out, I got an email in my inbox that I thought was someone trolling me, because this person was emailing and saying, I'm Kathy Kleiner. I survived the Chi Omega Ted Bundy attack. And I had read her name so many times in so many books. I just couldn't believe that I was hearing from the real person, but I was. It was really Kathy. We're best friends now. And I'm really excited to bring her on later, because these narratives are so often just the voice of the serial killer over and over. So I think it's really important that we hear her voice.
Yeah. So I'm definitely more into the serial killer documentary aspect.
Right. So to you, documentaries feel more authentic, I guess. Like, you feel more comfortable consuming them for that reason.
Yeah. So I was looking at how did we get to this point. What I came to find is that it's just that true crime is following the trends and following how modern society consumes true crime. So before, you did have a lot of newspaper articles, where now you have more dramatized Hollywood TV shows like Ryan Murphy's American Crime Story or Dirty John. And it also happened where, instead of documentaries, you also have the introduction of podcasts like Serial.
Or Red Flags.
Or Red Flags, exactly. And I think that when it comes to that, Hollywood has really taken advantage of that. And something that I was reading is that a lot of these true crime stories do very well to the point where they start winning awards. So a lot of Emmy winning, a lot of Oscar winning. And so Hollywood has taken full advantage of that. And I think with that also comes a sense of artistic or creative license to take the story and make it what you want. Where I always feel like documentaries do a better job of staying true to the story.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the age-old debate between fiction and nonfiction. I've been in writing classrooms where people argue which one gets at the truth better. The stuff that's technically true, like the documentaries, the nonfiction, the beat-by-beat factual stuff. Or is it possible that fiction can sort of get to the emotional truth easier or quicker or more effectively? Sometimes I'm inclined to be like, fiction, but it sounds like you're maybe more on the documentary side of things.
Yeah, but I do understand it. I do understand that when the consumer watches a more Hollywood version of it, it does feed that hunger for reality while at the same time still being able to detach from the real world, which is weird.
Yeah, we sort of get to have our cake and eat it too. So when it comes to documentaries, do you have specific favorites?
Yeah. So this month I watched the 93 Victims of Samuel Little on Investigation Discovery. And this is a case that we will be talking about again later on in the season. I watched the Ted Bundy tapes on Netflix. And I also watched a documentary on YouTube about Sante and Kenny Kimes.
Karina, they're in my book that's coming out February 23rd. Thank you for that. Aren't they out of control?
Oh my God. It was so horrifically interesting and horrific. I don't have another word for it. And it was also like, how have I not heard about this before?
I know.
Quick summary of what it is. It's this mother and son who go on a road trip, I guess you could say, across America, murdering wealthy people.
Yes, tabloids called them Mommy and Clyde. So that kind of gives you their vibe.
Yeah, it's definitely something to spend hours researching and binge watching too.
Yes, and purchasing books on.
So, Tori, I actually have a true crime confession for you.
Ooh.
I never went through a serial killer phase.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's a point in every true crime consumer where it's like they get awakened to serial killer world and they have to spend an entire weekend trying to figure everything out.
Mm, interesting. And Karina, I was going to take on the burden of educating you and giving you an assignment, right, of which movies you should watch. But then Thanksgiving happened and I wasn't checking my email. And sure enough, the Saturday after Thanksgiving, I get an email from Karina, who has gone ahead and given herself a syllabus. And might I add, it was flawless. Which movies did you choose to watch?
I watched My Friend Dahmer. I watched Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile. I watched Zodiac, and I wrapped everything up with Monster.
Mm. Yep. I think you've hit some of the big ones and some of the recent ones.
Mm-hmm.
So, Karina, I've been thinking about the different serial killer movies that are out there, and I've kind of categorized them in my mind in about four different ways. We're just going to dive into a couple of these, but let me tell you the four that I'm thinking. First, we have the He Was Just an Ordinary Guy films. These films try to intentionally show the serial killer as someone who is kind of similar to the rest of us. You know, could have been your neighbor, could have been your boyfriend. Then you have the manhunt type films. Zodiac is my big example of this, where it's maybe even less about the serial killer and you're really rooting for the detectives, the cops, the journalists, you know, the person who's not giving up. You have the empathetic films like Monster, which we'll talk about, where you really feel for the serial killer in a way that maybe makes you feel a little bit weird. And then maybe the most classic category, I would say, is like the monstrous films or the horrifying films. You know, just your films where the serial killer is super, super gruesome, horrific, and other. And those are films where you watch it and you're like, this serial killer is nothing like me. So Silence of the Lambs is one of them. There's a really horrific film called Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer that's about Henry Lee Lucas. That's kind of like your classic serial killer film in my mind. So in order to cast some more light on this subject, I talked to Professor David Schmid, who's at the University of Buffalo. He researches serial killers and pop culture, which I have to say, I think is so cool. And he has a book called Natural Born Celebrities, Serial Killers in American Culture. So he was the perfect person to bring on and talk about the relationship between Hollywood and serial killers. In your book, Natural Born Celebrities, you argue that the film industry is really responsible for creating the serial killer celebrity culture that we see today. How exactly did the relationship between serial killers and Hollywood start?
So if you're going to date this phenomenon of where the relationship between Hollywood and serial murder really starts to fall into place in a way that we would recognize now, I think you have to point to Silence of the Lambs.
Mm.
Like, that's really the moment where all of these different threads come together and you have a sort of full-fledged cultural phenomenon where serial killer as a sort of type that movies can be about enters the mass cultural consciousness. And at that point, we had reached a really interesting stage where the serial killer was in the process of being turned into a folk hero. And Hollywood was playing a major role in that.
And what happens when Hollywood starts making movies blatantly about real serial killers? Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer, Charles Manson. What happens then?
Obviously, there's a lot of debate about whether real-life serial killers are influenced by popular cultural representations, be it Hollywood or something else, and whether this creates serial killers, to put it bluntly. I think it's always been the case, and Silence of the Lambs is exemplary in this respect as well, that Hollywood fictional serial killer movies have taken their inspiration from real life cases. And that's part of the process by which a canon of famous serial killers becomes established. And that is kind of the precondition for the biopic. So once you have, let's say, Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer, John Wayne Gacy, Jack the Ripper, Eileen Wuornos, whoever it happens to be, then you start seeing films like Monster, which was based on Eileen Wuornos. Or you start seeing made-for-TV movies about Ted Bundy, like back in the 80s. What's interesting about what's happening right now, I think, is that when you look at the recent biopics of Bundy or at series like Mindhunter, the two things that jump out to me. First, these films assume an audience that's knowledgeable about serial killer culture and about serial killers. But the other thing I think is really interesting about them is that all of them, to one degree or another, are defined by nostalgia. And it's not just nostalgia for the 70s or the 80s as like a simpler time. It's a nostalgia for the figure of the serial killer himself. And I think it's driven by the fact that, as bizarre as it sounds, people can look back at figures like Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer and say to themselves, hey, that's the devil we know. That's the one that we're familiar with. That's the one that we grew up with. We're in the process of watching how serial murders are being turned into a kind of Americana. It's like part of our folk culture.
Interesting. So you say that most serial killer pop culture doesn't force us to ask why we're watching it. And now that is something we are trying to answer in the episode and probably not going to truly answer. But what would you say? Why do we watch this stuff? Do you have a theory?
I do think that what these films tap into is a kind of what I would describe as a sort of ambient fear that defines what it means to be American. And by that, I mean a sort of low level of anxiety that is just a defining part of our everyday lives. And that comes from the perception that we live in a violent society, that, you know, potentially we could be victimized at any time. And this is why, even though historically, you know, we've seen dramatic declines in the rates of violent crime over the last 20, 30 years, but you go and poll people and ask them how likely they are to be victimized, those numbers have remained remarkably constant. So there's that sort of, you know, disconnect between reality and perception. And I think that disconnect is one of the things that drives the market for serial killer pop culture. But in terms of where the fascination comes from, I think it's from the combination of two what appear to be contradictory facts. On the one hand, you have people who do things that are inconceivable, that we could never imagine doing. On the other hand, they look exactly like you and me. And it's that combination of the extraordinary and the ordinary that I think is at the core of our fascination with this figure, because it's what makes them so unsettling.
The last point that Professor Schmidt makes really resonated with me, because this was my experience with watching My Friend Dahmer. I understood, or at least I interpreted, that the purpose of the film was to show all these red flags. Because if you haven't seen My Friend Dahmer, it's pre-serial killer Dahmer. So it talks about his awkward teenage phase until he got to the point where he started killing people.
Yeah, it ends when he picks up his first victim, right? But it doesn't show a single crime.
No. And so throughout the entire movie, in my mind, I was like, I think they're trying to highlight the red flags, that these are the signs that someone is going to become a serial killer. So things like a broken family, feeling like an outsider at school, and also picking up roadkill and having a lab where you kind of hang out with dead animals. But weirdly enough, with My Friend Dahmer, I, in a very uncomfortable way, really related to him. And I have a story for you that I think might change the way that you see me.
Tell me.
But this was the part where I was like, oh no, like pre-serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer and I had a lot in common. So when I was younger, when I was around 13 or 14, I wanted to be a forensic anthropologist. Yeah, and I was obsessed with the TV show Bones, and I wanted to do that. I wanted to work with Bones. And one day, I was outside of my home playing, and I noticed something on the road. And I was like, oh, what is that? So I went to investigate, and it was a dead cat. But it was at the point where it was mostly bones. Oh. So I did what any child would do when they see an abandoned animal. And I asked my mom if I could keep it. And she said, yes, but you have to clean the bones first. Mm-hmm. So I like got a little tin box and I picked it up with gloves and I washed it. And for a good like 2 years, that was my most prized possession.
Kavina, you did such
a
good job.
I'm so sorry.
No, you were such forensic anthropologist. I think that's sweet. I think that this should be your second career when you turn 70.
Oh, yeah.
You should try to finally live out your dream and go to forensic anthropology school. So another film that I think fits under the he was just an ordinary guy category is Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile. Now, Karina, let me ask you, before you watched this film, did you know a lot about Ted Bundy's crimes?
The one that I feel I know kind of the most about is the Chi Omega one, but the individual ones I'm not too familiar with.
Yeah. Well, sadly, there were so many that that's a big ask. I'm asking you because I think that if someone doesn't know a lot about his crimes and watches the Zac Efron film, you're coming away with such an incomplete picture of what this dude did because it wasn't. This is going to sound awful. It wasn't that he just, air quotes, killed and assaulted women, but he also did things with their heads and decapitated them and revisited corpses. I mean, I don't even want to get into it here, but it was like this extra level of desecration to the bodies. Mm-hmm. And would you know that from the Zac Efron movie? Would you know any of that?
No.
But would you know that Zac Efron has nice abs, thus implying that Ted Bundy had nice abs?
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's why for so long I was so detached to serial killer Hollywood movies. Mm-hmm. I don't know, because I know people are like, oh, there's no such thing as evil people. It's just people with problems. But I'm someone who I do think that there's evil people. And it's harsh whenever you have these type of movies where you constantly have to remind yourself, no, this person's evil.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go ahead and talk about Monster. So it sounds to me like you're saying a hesitation you have with fictionalized films about serial killers is they're fiction, but the crimes really happened. You have to force yourself to remember that they're real. Is that fair?
Yeah.
When I watched Monster, it turned Eileen Wuornos into a three-dimensional person for me in a way that reading the coverage of her case hadn't ever. And maybe part of that is because Charlize Theron is like so incredible. And, you know, maybe part of that is just because Hollywood did a good job and made me feel things. But I felt like they stuck really close to her story and showed her personality from so many different angles that she just like sprung to life for me. And I was like, oh, my God, this really happened. Even though I was watching a technically fictional movie.
Monster. It was the one that I had the most interesting experience with emotionally because it got to a point where I started to feel so bad for her. Mm-hmm. And I really started to empathize with her and saying, oh, my God, can she just catch a break? Like, why is she going through this? And then another part of me was like, no, Karina, she's a serial killer. Like, she's a murderer. Mm-hmm. You need to stop. I think it's normal to go through these emotions. Mm-hmm. And trying to figure out, how do I actually feel about this?
I think it's natural to wrestle with those two sides of yourself. And I would actually be more gracious to the side of yourself that wants to empathize. I mean, there is so much in her life that is empathizable, if that's a word. Mm-hmm. And I think well done true crime or well done movies like Monster, they force you to hold both of those truths at the same time, which is really hard.
Yeah.
Because you're like, how can both of these things be true? But they just are.
So for me, this is how I made peace with it. I don't feel bad to the point where I excuse what she's done because I don't think that at all. But it did make me realize that in a lot of true crime, the idea of a perpetrator and a victim are not mutually exclusive. You have a lot of true crime cases where the victim is also a perpetrator of a crime or a perpetrator of a crime is a victim of a different crime. And I think it's coming to peace with that idea that not everything is so mutually exclusive and black and white and as simple.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't want to come off like, oh, I sympathize so much in these poor serial killers, because I don't at all. Yeah. But when you kind of see them painted in this different light, I think it does make you start to question your feelings. And I think it's something that I'm never going to understand fully. I think this is just going to go on through my whole true crime journey.
Yeah, until you turn 70 and become a forensic anthropologist. Mm-hmm. And then you'll have all the answers. So, Karina, whenever I research lightly about, you know, why do we consume this stuff as a culture, the popular answer is because there is darkness within us. What do you think about that theory? Karina's making a shocked face.
Tori, I just don't agree with this theory because I think it's overly simplistic to say that we all have this inner darkness in us that this is somehow feeding. Because in a way, it's saying that we kind of relate to these crimes and what is being done and we relate to the killer, which I feel like even though I was the weird kid who kept dead cat bones, I just feel like I'm not capable of that and I just don't relate to it.
Yes, I totally agree. It's simplistic. And that's why I like talking to Professor David Schmid. His explanations for this are a lot more nuanced. And he's not the only person in academia who's grappling with this question. So I did a little digging and came up with some other theories about why we like watching these movies. And I wanted to float a couple by you and get your reactions. You do not have to agree with these.
Okay.
Okay, so one theory that author Robert Conrath says in a paper called The Guys Who Shoot to Thrill is that the serial killer is kind of like the ultimate but dysfunctional American dream figure who's a consumer. He says that serial killers stalk their victims just as they shop for meat at the supermarket, with a discerning eye for those subtle differences between generic products that makes one of them somehow special, unique. They represent gone shopping, quote unquote, gone awry, in a day and age when shopping has become a sort of personal quest for authentication. So serial killer as consumer, like shopping for victims. What do you think about that?
That's actually really disturbing to think about.
Yeah. Is it uncomfortable because it feels like a little true?
Yeah. Yeah. It does feel true. I can see where they're coming from. But also the idea of you thinking of a human being as you would grocery shopping is very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's obviously like nothing any of us want to sign off on. But it also does seem like that is how serial killers work. I think what Robert Conrath is arguing is like part of why we as a culture can't get enough of serial killers is because in that way, they're like us, except, you know, we're shopping for groceries and they're shopping for victims. It's not quite the same as like we see their darkness in ourselves, but it's more like we see their consumerism in ourselves, which sounds so weird to say out loud, but I think he has a point. Okay, so here's another theory, and this one is presented by Caroline Jo S. Pickhart and Cecil Greek, who wrote about this in the Journal of Criminal Justice and Popular Culture, which sounds like my dream journal. So this is a theory not about why we like serial killer films, but sort of like why they need to exist. They write about how the actual FBI, like the real FBI, has admitted on multiple points that they consume fiction, like detective fiction, crime fiction, etc., which is really weird to think about, but apparently they do. The original Mindhunters did, I think. And anyway, these academics are arguing that serial killer movies shouldn't be kept just in pop culture, like they shouldn't just be something that you and I consume, but that they should be sort of fed into criminology because fictional representations of crimes can help the field of criminology. Isn't that kind of weird?
No, it weirdly makes sense because I think that, and again, as a professional binge watcher and apparently now binge listener too, it's easier to point out patterns when you see things back to back or see things in such a memorable way like a movie where it's like, oh, Jeffrey Dahmer had a beetle. Ted Bundy also had a beetle. Like you start making these connections that maybe before they weren't so obvious. So I think that maybe the dramatization highlights points that are later on helpful to kind of notice a pattern. After doing my movie assignment and also taking all of the documentaries that I've already watched into account, something that I struggle with is that a lot of them are not victim-based. So, for example, in a lot of the movies that I watched, I did notice that the victims became this sort of passing character that you don't get attached to and you don't know anything about them. So when they get killed in the movie, it's hard for you to have this emotional connection to them.
Yeah, that's something that this genre is always going to struggle with, I think. I mean, the reason these stories are being told is because of the serial killer. You know, the serial killer is the one who steps in and makes the plot happen. I mean, not to sound completely crass. So, of course, we're focusing on them. But you raise a really good point that a lot of times the victims are, I mean, in some of the movies we've already discussed, they are not even on screen. Like, there's not even an actor who was ever hired to play them. So I thought that it would be good to hear from a real person who survived a serial killer, which is why we brought on Kathy Kleiner, who actually survived Ted Bundy and who can tell us a little bit about what it's like to see your attacker portrayed on film.
My name is Kathy Kleiner. I'm a survivor of Ted Bundy. In 1978, I was attacked in Tallahassee in my room at the Chi Omega sorority house.
This episode, we're talking about serial killers in Hollywood. So what, if any, serial killer movies have you seen?
Pretty much. I've watched all the movies that come on TV. There aren't any that I shy away from or don't want to watch. I find them very interesting. Regardless of my past, I just find them interesting genre to watch.
I think something that's fascinating to me about you is I feel like people would assume you wouldn't ever want to see a film about Bundy. You would be too traumatized. And I've talked to you many times now, and you're always like, oh no, I read all the books. I see all the movies.
I'm very interested in how obviously he's portrayed in the different films and movies. Mm-hmm. I find it healing. I wanted to see how they portrayed all the stories. And also, if they did show the part of the Cayo house, I wanted to know if they showed who I was and who would act for me. So I do find them interesting. Right. It does make me sad to watch the movies and then they do not recognize the victims. They do not give them a face or life or dreams. And they kind of just show them as particularly a body that Bundy has killed. And that is so sad because he took all these women away from us, from this world so soon than they should have been.
Tell me a little bit about the trial itself, because I know there was a key question there that revolved around whether or not you'd seen Bundy's face before.
When I testified, I was scared. I was 21 years old and frightened and didn't know what to expect. So when I sat down in the witness stand, I looked around the room. And when I looked at the defense table, I saw Ted Bundy sitting there. And I looked at him. And my eyes didn't wander around the room anymore. I just looked at him and I was, I don't know if I wasn't scared. I was mad. I was upset. I had a burning feel of just going to get him and hurt him. And now at this point, I had control of myself and I felt strong. One of the defense questions that was asked, is this the man you saw in your room that night who attacked you in Chi Omega? Again, my eyes started welling up and I had to say, no, I don't know if it was him. And it made me feel so sad inside because he attacked me. He hurt me and my sorority sisters. And I could not help condemn him. I could not help have him convicted. And that hurt me so bad that I wanted to help to put him away for all of us, for as many victims as I could.
You knew it was him, but you hadn't technically seen his face that night. So you couldn't technically say, yes, that's the guy. Do you think that is why you are so interested in seeing films about him? And because you didn't technically see his face, is it giving you some sort of catharsis to now see his face as much as you can and consume as much as you can about him?
I think you're right, because all along I had this black, ugly silhouette in front of me. And I saw that, and that's all I remembered. And I did not have a face. But you're right, reading everything and seeing as much as I can, there is a face on it. And it, I think it helps me to heal because, once again, it wasn't just this black thing that attacked me. It was Ted Bundy. And that made me realize that he's sick, he was real, and this is the face that he wore.
Tori, I really enjoyed your interview with Kathy because it really put things into perspective for me. I think as someone who I try to be very victim-centered and very empathetic to victims and survivors, it was really shocking to me to hear that she watches this type of content specifically on Ted Bundy because I always assumed that that was uncomfortable for them and it was in a way weirdly disrespectful. And I always had that in the back of my mind.
Yeah, well, it's a good reminder for us all, I think, that, you know, not all survivors are like, they don't necessarily want the same things or shy away from the same things. I mean, I was just like you. The first time I talked to Kathy, I was ready for her to go on this long rant about how much she hated all this Ted Bundy content that we're seeing. And she was like, oh, I watch it all. So yeah, it's a good reminder that we just need to always turn back to the victim and ask them how they feel about it.
Yeah, definitely shy away from the assumption and just look at it firsthand and see how they feel.
One of the diabolically clever things about serial killers and how they sort of make themselves into celebrities is when you kill 30 plus people like Ted Bundy, there is literally not enough time in a movie about you to cover all your victims. Like, it's like they, I don't want to say they intentionally do it, but they make it so the reality of their crimes means we don't have the space to focus on the victims. Like, we don't have the mental capacity to even remember all the victims' names. A lot of that responsibility falls on us as the media. I mean, you and I know that the true crime world could do a lot better with centering victims. But I do think there's this really sinister truth of these crimes, which is just like, we don't have the space.
I actually read this quote where Ted Bundy was being interviewed by journalist Hugh Ainsworth, and he was talking about serial killers and body counts, and Bundy said, "The higher the number, the better. The more horrified people will be, the more they will read, and the more interested they'll be in finding out what makes a person like this tick. Make it up. I'm not going to do it. I can't, but you can."
Ugh. So Ted Bundy was very aware of his status as celebrity and his potential as celebrity, right?
Yeah, because that's what it sounds like, because he's encouraging people to kind of sensationalize him and say, oh, I can't make that number up, but you have the ability to do that. So go as high as you want, because it's going to get people's attention.
Yeah.
And they're going to read about it.
We gave him exactly what he wanted.
Yeah.
So I know we've gone over a lot of theories about why we like these movies, why we keep making these movies. And I just want to end with my favorite one. The one that resonates with me the most.
Okay.
And you can tell me what you think about it. This is another theory from Robert Conrath, who was the guy with the shopping for victims consumerist theory. But he kind of wraps up his piece by arguing that serial killers are so distinctly unique that that's why we can't get enough of them. He says that basically, as a society, we all worry that we're kind of on an assembly line, right? Like, we want to be unique so bad. But when we look at our year-end Spotify Wrapped, a lot of us had Taylor Swift's Folklore as the most listened to album, right? So, so we all have this sneaking suspicion that we're not as special as we want to be. And that's why we love celebrities. And he mentions Madonna and Prince and Michael Jackson as these real aberrations, like, everyone's like a shrink-wrapped plastic doll, and then Madonna and Prince and Michael Jackson, they just jump off the assembly line because they're so amazing. And the sad truth is serial killers do the same thing. They also jump off the assembly line and show us that they're unique. You can argue a lot about Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer, but you can't say they weren't aberrations and they weren't sort of these unique, thank God, figures. And so this theory And this rings true to me, is that we watch serial killer movies not because there is darkness within us all and we all secretly want to be serial killers, but because we all secretly or openly want to be unique. And so that's why we turn these killers into celebrities and can't get enough of them, because we suspect that we're regular and mediocre and boring.
Yeah. And in a really dark way, and I mean this in the most respectful way possible, Tori and I are always very victim-centered and try to keep that in mind. But it's almost to the point where we feel as normal as the victims, where we feel like we were also, like with Ted Bundy, Chi Omega, I was also in a sorority. I was also just this regular girl going to school. And it's such a difficult thing to think about and make peace with in a weird way. But I do see what you're saying, where there is this fascination to them because they're so different and they think so differently than us. And a lot of people who are into true crime, when you talk to them about serial killers, they always say, oh, I'm so interested in them because I am interested in the psychology of it. Why do they do the things they do? Why do they react to the way they do to things? What makes them act in that way? Because as an, hopefully, whoever's listening, is an average all-day individual, we can't wrap our minds around it and we can't understand it.
And I think as much as we loathe and disapprove of their actions, we are drawn to the fact that they broke through the rules of society and, again, stepped off the assembly line and made themselves famous. So, Karina, we got our first voicemail.
That's actually really exciting.
Yeah, check it out.
Hi, my name is Damon, and I'm calling from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I would like you to cover something related to the John Wayne Gacy case, where he talked about possibly having accomplices related to his various crimes. Thanks. Love this podcast so far. Bye.
Damon, your timing is impeccable, because ID actually has an entire narrative podcast coming out on December 15th that's about this question. It's called The Clown and the Candyman. It's about the potential horrific link between John Wayne Gacy and another serial killer, Dean Corll. And the podcast is actually a prequel to a miniseries coming out on ID in January. So check that out for some answers. But Damon, your question also sent me down a rabbit hole of my own. I've sent some emails. I'm doing some digging. So I'll get back to you in the near future. And if you guys want us to respond to your voicemail, you know you can call us at 888-9-R-E-D-F-L-A, which is 888-973-3352.
We both want to recommend a podcast that we love called Fruit Loops, and it focuses on serial killers of color. So we really suggest that you listen to that.
I think that Fruit Loops started right when I was starting my podcast, Criminal Broads. And I remember, like, we followed each other on Instagram and we were like, yay, like, we each have like 100 followers. And then life got busy and I stopped listening to podcasts for a while. And I recently went back to them and they're so good. One of the hosts does like a customized song if you donate to their Patreon. Like, she'll do a song with your name in it, which I can only aspire to that one day.
I love that.
It's so cute.
Thank you so much to our guests, Kathy Kleiner and Professor Schmid, and thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Bye. For more true crime conversations, be sure to check out ID on Twitter at DiscoveryID or on Instagram and TikTok at InvestigationDiscovery.
And you can ask us questions on our own Instagram feeds too. I'm at Tori_Telfer.
And I am at the Karina Michelle.
Thanks for listening today. Red Flags is a production of Investigation Discovery and Audiation. For ID, our executive producers are Jessica Lowther and Amy Angelowitz.
For Audiation, our executive producers are Sandy Smallins and Michael Wolfson.
Mark Lotto is our story editor, Ireland Meacham is our producer, and Brad Stratton is our editor-mixer.
Theme music by Marty Beller.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states.
UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.